contained in this recent work, and in particular in the supplement. There are a lot of details which I'm not going to be able to cover.
This is joint work with my graduate student, soon to be postdoc, Winton Brown. Winton is actually here, right there in the audience. And I'm mentioning this because he deserves a lot of credit for this work, and also because he's kind of, how to say, the wizard behind a lot of the most technical details involved into the proofs and everything. So make sure you save all the hardest questions for him at the end. And as far as I am concerned, let me try to, well, given the time constraint, nevertheless, to give a little bit of motivation and background to set the stage for the particular question that I want to address. So, quantum randomness and random matrix theory, I just wanted to say that nobody mentioned that yet. Random matrices, of course, they are useful across a variety of applied areas. I think they were introduced in statistics, then they spread out across mathematics. And as far as physics is concerned, I'm a physicist, I think that they were making their inception in physics in the 50s in connection with studying disorder system and quantum chaos, and they've been extremely useful for looking at statistical properties of those systems from then on. However, what has become increasingly clear over the last decade or so, a little bit more actually, is that random quantum objects, and I will focus mostly, when I use this word, on random unitary operators. However, I just want to take the chance to say that whenever we operate with a random unitary operator on a fixed reference state, we also get an ensemble of random pure state, and I believe maybe Carol you'll be talking about ensemble of random states. So random objects have become a fundamental resource across quantum information theory. Luckily for me, this morning Patrick was giving a little bit of an overview on that, and in particular he pinpointed one of the earliest, to my knowledge, and one of the most important properties that random unitaries have. They give us very efficient encoders, as Patrick was giving an example of that. And ultimately, that property also, of course, I won't have the time to do that. And moreover, many of the people who came up with proposing these protocols are right here. This property that random unitaries have make them extremely useful in a whole variety of protocols related to communication, cryptography, and so on and so forth. Let me just mention another property. In addition to random unitaries being very nice encoders, there is something else that I want to flesh out, at least to mention the word, because I believe it will come up in many other talks, maybe the one right after me, and that is the fact that random unitaries, they also are very powerful in that they bias immediately the advantage of Patrick mentioned the law of large numbers. There is kind of a quantum or a measure theory version of it, which has to do with concentration of measure in large Hilbert spaces. And that is very, very useful because it's enforcing the emergence of typical behavior with a lot of useful properties. I have fleshed out one particular or an application that I found suggestive, as a physicist at least, and that is the possibility that we can, by having access, in principle, to just one application of a random operator, we can come up with protocols. One of them is based on so-called superoperator twirling, which I believe Carol was one of the authors, Joseph Emerson, and a bunch of other people. And because of concentration of measure, essentially, even if we have access to just one instance of a unitary operator, and we are able to kind of extract this kind of complicated overlap, but essentially you start with a state, you apply the unitary, then the channels come in, you undo it and then project on the initial state, well, it can be shown that that number is exponentially close to the value for the average, hard average gate fidelity, which in turn gives us an unbiased estimation of the overall strength of the noise. And this is a scalable procedure for estimating noise parameter, which is very important for fault-tolerant computation. So main message, slide number one, quantum randomness is extremely useful. This usefulness doesn't come for free, And in order to make the point, let me just be a tiny bit more formal. What we mean by a randomly unit, by a randomly distributed unitary, in the language of the classical circular ensemble that were introduced at least in the physics literature by Dyson, Bittner and company, we are talking about an operator which is distributed according to the CUE, and of course the relevant probability measure that we are concerned with is the uniform, the unique invariant R measure on the unitary group, and I'm going to be concerned with a state space of dimension capital N, which I will be viewing as 2 to the little n, which is n is the number of qubits. In fact, the volume, the size of this space, even though it's a compactly group, well, I mean, the volume grows exponentially fast with the number of subsystems, with the number of qubits, and the consequence of it, which probably you know very well already, but it's worth emphasizing, is that if we think about a circuit implementation which achieves an exact implementation of this ensemble, of the CUE, that requires exponential resources in the sense of requiring a decomposition in terms of single and two qubit gates which are taken from a fixed universal set, which has a number of gates order of the dimension of the Hilbert space square, which is order of something which scales exponentially in the number of qubits. So that means an exponential, exponentially growing quantum complexity plus there is also an exponential number of independent classical parameters that are needed to parameterize exactly the unitary group that we would like to generate. So message of this is, randomness is useful in principle. However, the notion of quantum randomness might be too hard, might be too strong a notion, at least from a practical standpoint. So perhaps this can be a big motivation for looking into a weaker requirement, namely whether we can come up with substitutes of hard distributed operators or states which can still be good for, of course, you have to give up something, so they have to be good only with respect to a restricted set of statistical features or statistical tests. So we're going to call this concept the concept of a pseudo-random unitary operator, and again, we're going to have pseudo-random ensemble of states accordingly. So this notion was proposed by Emerson co-workers a few years ago, and I depicted here their very first suggestion for a concrete circuit implementation to get a pseudo-random unitary operator. So in particular, what they were considering here is a random quantum circuit which would consist of iterations of basically the blocks, and in each of these blocks, the particular choice that they picked is like these little boxes here, they are meant to represent random single qubit, so U2 rotations, whereas these couplings here, they are fixed nearest neighbor Ising coupling, and the reason why this choice was picked was because this particular circuit was also been implemented in a liquid state nuclear magnetic resonance processor where the Ising coupling comes pretty much naturally. So that's the notion of a random circuit. As you will see, I will have a different class which will include related circuits as well. What they have also studied in that paper up there by Emerson, Richard Cleave actually as well, and Etera Levine and others, they have analyzed how well pseudo-random operators can represent the target measure that we would like to have, which is the Hard measure. So the main conclusion of a theorem is like, provided that the measure from which we pick the gate has support on a universal gate set, if we look at the measure which we get over random circuits, that converges exponentially fast in K. K is the circuit depth, is the number of iterations that we have, in particular in this case of the block that I have. What they prove rigorously is that we have an exponentially fast convergence to the Hard measure By the way, this denotes the K-fold convolution, which is the appropriate way to take products of a probability measure in this case. And the statement is like in the limit of infinitely long circuit depth, the relevant measure after kth iteration does converge as we desire to the hard measure on the unitary group in question. Yes.
Say what the Ising yes, I will copy.
Yes, well done. This is jargon. Ising means a sigma z interaction. Similarly to what we had in a previous talk, but this is quantum, so it was implemented this spin. Sorry, if there is too much jargon, raise your hand. So, we have convergence to the hard measure, so eventually,
pseudo random ensemble is going to become a hard uniformly distributed one. It doesn't mean that the rate for which this convergence takes place is going to be scaling favorably, but in fact, although there is no rigorous proof in that paper, they also mentioned that this rate of convergence will have, in general, to decrease exponentially with the number of qubits. But as far as what we are concerned with, the point is we do asymptotically converge to the hard measure. From a practical standpoint, again, if we fix the circuit depth, if we look at the finite k, how could we, so to speak, quantify the extent, the quality of the randomization that has been achieved? And in that case, what we really need is a systematic framework that can give us a way to talk about ensembles of unitary operators which are precisely matching only a subset of moments of the hard measure. That is the notion that essentially a unitary T-design captures. So let me just recall that the definition of what I will call the T-order moment of a distribution on U on N, this can be viewed as an expectation value of, there is this word balance, T monomial. T is the order of the moment I am interested, and this is going to be an expectation over the distribution of objects of this form. So we have a string of matrix elements, and notice that there are T entries which are unconjugated, T entries which are conjugated. So that also can be expressed in this form. I'm going to switch between the two notations, but that's what a moment is going to be from now on. And the definition of a unitary T-design, so for now an exact unitary T-design, is precisely a distribution, an ensemble of operators, so that if we essentially operate with that on any n-t-dimensional matrix, and we look at the expectation, the result is indistinguishable whether U is drawn from the distribution or U would be drawn according to the actual hard measure. So this is the definition of an exact design. It can be equivalently rephrased by requiring that all the T monomials that I was talking about in the line above have identical expectations, whether we take this expectation with respect to the actual distribution or with respect to the hard measure. Once again, turns out that this, although this is a weaker definition, we have done a step, but it's still a little bit too strong, because if we ask about efficient construction of exact unitary T-designs, so far at least, the one that we know is only existing for T equal 2, it has to do with the so-called Clifford group. So can we relax further? And the answer is yes. And the kind of natural way to relax further is to essentially give up the condition that the moments have to be exactly matching up, but they only have to be close with respect to an accuracy epsilon that is going to define the notion of an epsilon approximated T design. So the definition that I put up here, as again, is phrased in terms of expectations of this T order monomial, and they have to be close. The accuracy is determined by epsilon. I would like to, you know, there is a caveat here. There are various slightly different definitions of choice of the norm with which you define this closeness is exactly, well, there are some subtleties there, but for practical purposes, let me continue and just saying that the meaning of a unitary T-design essentially is that operationally, if we are only being concerned with a statistical test where we only use at most T copies of a given unitary U, well, there is no way to distinguish whether we have that or we actually would be given the actual hard distributed ensemble. Yeah, please.
What is known, how many of those unitaries you have to take to construct your T-design? What is the minimal number?
I'm going to probably mention something in that respect. So that's the definition. And it turned out that this notion of approximate T-designs is indeed useful, is a practical resource that we can use for a lot of quantum tasks in quantum information. This is a partial list, and probably it's better that I don't go through, because otherwise I won't move to what I really want to mention. But what I want to say is that it is sufficient for a lot of the tasks that we care about. There probably are more tasks that await to be discovered, in particular for T larger than 2. And let me also mention, this goes back exactly to the question that was hinted at. In some of these papers that you see mentioned here, in particular in the work by Dunkert, Emerson, and co-workers, and also in this other work by Plenius' group, where they were realizing actually that a second-order design would be sufficient, for instance, to reproduce the behavior of typical entanglement as captured by subsystem purities, while there are also construction, explicit circuit constructions for constructing two designs, and they have a polynomial number of, so they can be constructed efficiently, even though the details are slightly different. So the message is like this. Unitary design, they come with the requirement of, you know, in principle, we would like to construct them efficiently. So the notion of efficiency is here. So we are going to call an epsilon approximate unitary design to be efficient if we have an algorithm for sampling it, for sampling and implementing a unitary which is drawn from the design, which uses a polynomial. Well, essentially, this is the number of qubits that we have, the log of the capital N, and then we have to have a polynomial in the logarithm of 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is the degree of accuracy. So, question, can we divide concrete construction in general beyond the one that I hinted at in those particular papers? And I should mention that there are construction for state T designs, so for the equivalent notion, but just for state. However, they do not appear to naturally at least extend to unitary T design. So I believe the first construction for epsilon approximate unitary T design is due to a gentleman here in this room, Aram, and though they have come up with an efficient scheme which is based on so-called quantum key copy tensor product expanders, and it works out. There are some subtleties on the value of T for which it works efficiently, how it is related to N. But from the perspective that I want to take here is like I would like to ask the following. In some sense, T designs, pseudo-random unitary operators that I started introducing, they are meant to capture the same notion of pseudo-randomness, and in particular pseudo-random unitary operator, they were originally introduced to be generated through random circuits. So the natural question that can come up is like, to what extent can T-designs emerge from generic random dynamics, and in particular, to what extent can a random circuit itself be used to produce, to generate a unitary T-design? Once again, the first step in this direction was taken by Haram, because in this work last year,
there is an argument that indicates that a random circuit on n qubits can give us one and two design, and there is also a conjecture that a random circuit of a length which scales polynomially with the number of qubits t and the accuracy that we have should give us an epsilon approximate t design. So the rest of this talk is going to touch upon this conjecture, and in particular the question I want to address and tell you the progress that we have in that direction is, to what extent can we characterize how quickly statistical moments of arbitrary order t do converge? So that's the question that will keep me occupied, and the techniques we use there, well, I try to give you as much detail as possible, but I thought it would be a good idea first, because I'm certainly not going to make it on time, through all the detail, to state the assumption under which the results will hold, and then state the results themselves, so we know what we are talking about. So some assumption on the class of random circuits that are going to be considered in what follows. There is a pictorial representation here. So the kind of random circuits that I'm going to be concerned with, they are constructed by having n qubits, of course, and at each time step, what I imagine is to pick a pair of distinct qubits uniformly and independently at random. And then, once I pick the pair, I will apply to that pair a gate which is selected from a universal single and two qubit gate set on U4. And the assumption that I'm going to make on this, I'm going to call mu tilde, the probability distribution over U4. Soon enough, you're going to see a mu as well. Mu is always intended to represent the measure on the full set of qubits. So the condition that I'm going to put on this probability distribution mu tilde is that it is obeying this reversibility condition over here. The class, any type of random quantum circuit which will satisfy one and two, I'm going to generally refer to just as a permutational invariant random circuit. There is also another possibility if on top of these two conditions it so also happens that the distribution mu tilde is invariant. This is on U4. Suppose that it is also invariant under the subgroup of local unitary single qubit transformation. I am going to refer to that subclass of circuits which have 1, 2, and 3 as local invariant random circuits. So that's the class of circuits relevant here. There are two claims, one of which is true for the broader class, the other one which holds for that subclass of local invariant circuit, and here it goes. So the first result is like, for any permutational invariant random circuit on n qubits, pick an arbitrary fixed order of the statistical moment that you want to examine, and then you will have exponential convergence in circuit depth to the hard value for that with a rate. With this rate, I have denoted that delta t here that decreases linearly with n, so this is the statement mathematically. There is going to be a serious expansion, but the key point is like the leading term is a coefficient, which is non-vanishing, divided n, and that correction, which are going to be small in the limit of large n. In general, I would like to stress from the outset that this coefficient can depend on the order t under consideration, in general. Claim two, however, if you have the subset of circuits which are also locally invariant, what is possible to prove that the second result is that to leading order, so focusing on this coefficient in the expansion in large n, you can show that this asymptotic convergence rate, delta t, does not depend upon t, to leading order. So that coefficient A1. So the implication of this will be basically, once we have a convergence rate, you'll see I mentioned that you also have naturally an upper bound on the circuit length, so the really the convergence time that you want to have, and this places an upper bound on the minimum circuit length, so that indeed a random circuit of a length which is linear in the number of qubits and in the log of the accuracy that we have does give us an epsilon approximate unitary phi design of order t. That's the statement. You see already some strange faces here in the first row. And let me just flash out at least or start telling you the approach by which, yes, let me go back, Aram. Yes, Aram, sorry.
The bottom, that's that scales like n log 1 of epsilon. I guess you mean there's a constant that depends on t.
Yes.
Yeah.
In general, yes. The constant can depend on t unless we are in this subclass for which if n is sufficiently large, so you are...
But then it would just be linear in t, right? In that sort of most optimistic...
I don't want to make any claim on the exact dependence on t, because this is, in fact, my last slide will have it as an open question.
Oh, okay.
What we could explore, given the techniques that we use, is having insight on the dependence upon n for fixed t. And I would like this to be clear, because otherwise it can cause misunderstanding. So, how do we establish these results? The first step to get towards that is to find a compact way to describe statistical moments of arbitrary order t. And in order to do that, I'd like to take you from the physical space of n qubits. Let's enlarge it to a space which I'm going to call the moment space, which consists of 2t, here it is, 2t copies of the n qubit space. So something like this, it has a dimension which is denoted by capital D, pretty large, is n to the 2t, but that's what it is. So from the pictorial point of view, it might be useful to visualize this set of essentially, we have this moment space. It can be visualized, if you see here, as nt, so t copies and qubits, so you have like a super cat notation, so that if what I want to get across is like we can, if we enlarge the picture from a physical n qubit space to a moment space, we can naturally think, even though we are applying a unitary operator on the n physical qubit, we can naturally think to an action of the circuit on t copies of the n qubit space, because there is the possibility of, look here, if you imagine this row being a density operator on n t qubits, the dimension match up correctly in such a way that you can view the transformation of this density operator on n t qubits as being operated by t copies of u on one side and u dagger the t on the other side, which is what I'm going to write like this in terms of a linear transformation. This defines a linear transformation, which in the language this morning Patrick was mentioning channels, well, transformation, linear transformation on density operators, on operators, they also sometimes called super operators, so I'm going to call this the moment super operator. And another tool that we often use is to actually view super operator just like standard operators, so we go back to linear algebra. The way to do that is to invoke the so-called UV representation, by which essentially, sorry, this morning we had cats, now I'm going to have like super cats, because a linear operator is going to be identified with an operator cat, and the corresponding bra is an operator bra. But all of this, just take it as a recipe that allows you to convert from this, essentially, this action on an operator in this way to an action of an operator which is given here on a vector. So we are back to linear algebra, and in this way, I can associate this moment super operator
if you like a D times D matrix, which is defined by this expression here. So what I want you to get across is that knowledge of this moment super operator immediately gives you access to knowledge of all the set of the order moments that you want to track. All right. So something more about this moment super operator. It has some desirable property. The first property that it has, which follows from that reversibility, and that's what motivated the name in the first place. Remember that I constrained the distribution new field for each qubit pair to obey the reversibility condition? These translate into giving me an Hermitian operator, an Hermitian matrix, in terms of the moment superoperator, MT. There is also, I was mentioning in reference to the result of Emerson, Levine, and co-workers, to the k-fold product in order to see how the measure converges to Haar measure. Well, for fixed order moment, that property as a natural translation in terms of the moment superator that you realize after k iteration. And the property, I refer to it as a forward composition property because it is a generalization of the property that also Markov chain obey. So you can view it as if the moment superoperator that you have for circuit of depth k can be seen, can be obtained by simply taking matrix product like this. So the proof is encapsulated in this line, but the message is this equality that you have at the end. Also, eigenvalue structure, this is a linear operator, we can talk about eigenvalues. It's pretty easy to convince ourselves that the norm, the modulus of all the eigenvalues is less or equal than 1, for all the possible eigenvalues, and in particular, the largest eigenvalue, the extremal eigenvalue, which is equal to 1, has a well-characterized eigenspace, and it corresponds to the set of fixed points, that the way in which we have defined this empty superoperator, the extremal eigenspace, and I have called it VT, and it is generated. This is a fixed point condition. These are supercats, but you know, it just means that under the action of this operator, these states are fixed, so fixed point condition there, and this will have important consequences in what I'm going to say in a little bit. So with these properties of the moment superoperator, What is relatively straightforward to show, and actually it also follows from results which were contained in this paper by Haro and Lowe, it is possible to show that the convergence properties of the measure mu k to the Haar measure, they directly translate into convergence of the moment superoperator to the moment superoperator, which corresponds to the Haar measure. And let me just note, because this is important to know, that the moment superoperator that corresponds to the Haar measure is a very simple mathematical object because it coincides with the projector onto the site of fixed points here. All right. Okay. Because the moment corresponding to the Haar measure is indeed that projector onto the set of fixed points, if we want to characterize the approach of the moment superoperator to the Haar moment superoperator, well, we only have to care about the non-extrema, so those eigenvalues and eigenprojectors which corresponds to the eigenvalues which are strictly less than 1, and this is, take any unitary invariant norm, and if the circuit depth is sufficiently large, you can convince yourself that the rate of convergence is depending, well, I have called the lambda 1 here, the subdominant eigenvalue, which I let to be equal to 1 minus a strictly positive quantity, which is the spectral gap, and what we see from here is that the convergence is exponential in circuit length with a rate which is essentially determined by the subdominant eigenvalue, which is essentially, if you follow this obvious equality, determined by the spectral gap that we have. Now, if we know that spectral gap, one comment that follows is also that we can bound the convergence time, which is going to be defined by the minimum circuit length, which is required for the distance between the actual moment superoperator to be less than desired from the actual hard superoperator. So I would like to have a few minutes to tell you how to estimate the gap. So let me just skip these steps and tell you that if you have figured out the scaling of the relevant spectral gap, it is pretty straightforward to see that the convergence time is bounded. This is the relationship by that. So the whole problem is to get a handle on how to estimate the spectral gap. So, fine, okay.
Let me see the basic thing, but with the questions?
Or? No,
that's okay.
Yes. All right, because the key thing is like, how can we estimate the spectral gap? And at least the strategy is as follows. The first step to that is to have a closer look at our moment superoperator and realize that it actually comes with some locality and symmetry properties that make it possible for us to map it to a model from many body physics. That's the first insight. And the properties I am referring to, the locality properties, they automatically follow from the fact that whenever I apply a gate that operates non-trivially on just 2 qubits, which is part of the circuit assumption that I have made, well, this causes the total moment superoperator to decompose into a sum of operators which have only support, which are only going to be non-trivial on the what I call here the bilocal moment spaces, because we can group together the moment action pertaining to each qubit together. And that I didn't underline that before, but that gives us a decomposition of the total moment space into local moment space, which are qubit by qubit. So locality means in reference to the qubit in general, and in this case, it gives us a sum of terms which, as I wrote here, they have support on bilocal spaces. Each of these local spaces is going to have a dimension which is equal to 4 to the t. Then I also said in my circuit assumption that each pair is picked uniformly at random. That translates into an easy symmetry property, which means that the moment superoperator we are going to get is completely invariant under qubit relabeling. So all in all, this means that we can express the total moment superoperator up to a constant as a sum of objects which, as I said, they operate non-trivially. I mean, they touch only bilocal moment space. So in other words, if you consider the restriction to the any pair of local spaces, you get an expression for this empty, and the indices disappear because the action is the same for any pair of qubits that you have. That's the consequence of permutation invariance. So all in all, if we look at what this means that this is an Hermitian operator. What we have, we can think physically of it as a Hamiltonian. It's a Hamiltonian which is permutational invariant, and the subsystems on which it operates, they are d-dimensional. And this d, so I called it a q, this d is determined by 4 to the q. So that's what we have, is a permutational invariant qt Hamiltonian. And the way to see that it really is permutational invariance, that the consequence it has is to introduce collective operators, because you can look at a basis for operators which act on each local moment space. And in spite of the fact that we start off having indices which keep track of the qubit, permutation invariance tells us that if we introduce collective operators, we end up having an action which is independent upon the qubit itself. So we end up having collective operators, and these collective operators, they obey commutation rules which are well known, and they are the commutation rules for the unitary algebra in two dimensions. So we end up having a collective Hamiltonian, and the good thing is that collective Hamiltonians have a long tradition in physics. They have been studied a lot. In particular, the most well-known case is one where the subsystems actually are just two-dimensional. So there is a class of models which is being introduced in nuclear physics to study phase transition. It's called the Lipkin-Meshkov-Glick model. Back in 1965, this is the standard case where the collective operators are nothing but the sum of the usual spin 1/2 operator. That's not going to be enough for our purposes, but what we have is a generalization of an Hamiltonian which is still expressible in terms of collective operators, but it is as if the individual subsystems that we are talking about, they are D-level. So what I am referring here, we have a D-level extension of the LMG, the Lipkin-Meshkov-Glick model, and that is going to do the trick in helping us to determine the ground state, the first excited state that we care about. All right. Okay, one comment. The comment, most importantly, is the fact that for any Lipkin Hamiltonian that you can come up with, all right, that's intimidating. There are a lot of approximate features that people have studied about the ground state manifold. What I wanted to stress is that for the particular class of Lipkin Hamiltonian that a random circuit, a permutational invariant random circuit supports, there is no need to invoke any approximation for characterizing the ground state manifold. We know it exactly, and that ground state manifold is exactly span, is exactly that DT that I was referring to before, and the key point is that it's exactly spanned by product space. So this is a property that is not generic of Lipkin models, but it holds true for those Lipkin models which are generated by random circuits. And I do believe that it has more implications than we have appreciated yet. So the ground state can be determined exactly. The first excited state, now we need a little bit of Lipkin techniques, but for the class of models which are collected, they have been extensively tested. And there should be much more to say about that. But if you believe that derivation of mean field that offers us an ansatz for the first non-trivial excitation, this is where the claim that I was referring to comes from. It gives us the stated scaling of the spectral gap with 1 over n, subject to technicalities, which, of course, I don't have the time to address. They are important, but they are fully addressed in the supplement of the paper, and I think we'll stop there for questions at this point. All right.
Question, let's thank the speaker again.